Lucas had no idea what was going to happen in Revenge of the Jedi. Beyond the title, he had little more than some notes scribbled on yellow pads. Harrison Ford, tiring of Han Solo, had urged Lucas to kill his character off, but Lucas had hedged his bets in Empire, merely deep-freezing Solo in carbonite. His fate, it seemed, hinged on whether Ford would sign for the third movie. But now that Lucas had slid a third Star Wars clause into Ford's contract for multiple Indiana Jones films, Solo seemed safe. Gary Kurtz still wasn't so sure. At one point, Kurtz and Lucas had sat down to discuss the plot of the final film, which Kurtz, who had loved Empire's more serious, grown-up feel, wanted to end on a more poignant, almost downbeat note. The original idea was that they would recover Han Solo in the early part of the story, recalled Kurtz, and that he would die in the middle part of the film in a raid on an Imperial base. That would have left Leia alone to assume her new duties as queen of the Upstart Alliance, with Luke riding off into the sunset, metaphorically, on his own. And that would have been a bittersweet ending, said Kurtz. But I think it would have been dramatically stronger. Lucas wouldn't even consider it, and Kurtz thought he knew why. During production on Empire, Kurtz had spent a fair amount of time ferrying representatives from the Kenner Toy Company around the set. Lucas was clearly keeping an eye on the toyetic qualities of his franchise, and George then decided he didn't want any of the principals killed, said Kurtz. Or, as Ford put it more sardonically, George didn't think there was any future in dead Han toys. It's a shame, said Kurtz later. They make three times as much on toys as they do on films. It's natural to make decisions that protect the toy business, but that's not the best thing for making quality films. The Lucas-Kurtz partnership, which had produced three of the most successful films in history in less than a decade, was on increasingly thin ice. Lucas was still smarting over Kurtz's budget busting on Empire, while Kurtz was wary of the growing influence of merchandising. But as Lucas worked his way through his first story treatment for Jedi, disregarding Kurtz's ideas for a bittersweet ending, one plot element finally cracked the ice for good. Lucas had made an assault on the Death Star a pivotal part of his story. It sounds redundant, he confessed, but we'll do it again. Kurtz wasn't going to do it again. We had kind of a mutual parting of the ways because I just didn't want to do another attack on the Death Star, he told an interviewer. So we agreed that I should probably leave. Lucas tapped Howard Kazanjian, who had already stepped in at the tail end of Empire and had served as his producer on Raiders, to fill the same role on Jedi. Kurtz, meanwhile, left to work with Jim Henson on his ambitious film, The Dark Crystal. It wasn't acrimonious, Kurtz said of his departure. It was just that Lucas felt he would probably be more comfortable with someone else handling the production on Jedi, and I felt I would prefer a different kind of challenge that wasn't kind of repeating something I had already done. While Kurtz would always refer to his relationship with Lucas as professional, the two of them would not work together again. With a new producer in place, Lucas turned next to the important matter of his director. Briefly, he considered Kirshner. Although he could be slow, Lucas liked him, but Kirshner dismissed the idea immediately. I didn't want to become simply another Lucas employee, said Kirshner. I love George, but I wanted to go my own way. In the meantime, Lucas had Kazanjian scouting for potential directors, though with Lucas's present persona non grata status with the Directors Guild, Kazanjian had to be picky. For the sake of both Lucas and his director. A DGA director could be blacklisted for working with Lucas, or the guild could force the director to walk off the film mid-project and fine him if he refused. Lucas was looking seriously at experienced directors like Richard Donner, up-and-comers like Joe Dante, and several quirky artistes like David Cronenberg and David Lynch. It was Lynch, in fact, who intrigued Lucas the most. At the suggestion of Stanley Kubrick, Lucas had screened a copy of Lynch's darkly disturbing Eraserhead and found it bizarre but interesting. It was the kind of highly personal filmmaking Lucas admired. Unfortunately, said Lynch, I had next to zero interest, but I always admired George. He's a guy who does what he loves, and I do what I love. Lynch went to visit with Lucas at the ranch, where Lucas took him for a ride in his Ferrari and then to lunch at a salad bar. Lynch came down with a mean migraine headache and, by his own recollection, crawled into a phone booth to call his agent. "No way I can do this," he moaned into the phone. "No way." The reason was simple. Lynch decided he didn't want to do a George Lucas movie, said Mark Hamill. He felt he couldn't be constantly answering to another producer. George didn't want to restrict someone that original. Lucas could only agree with Hamill's assessment. "I think I may have gone a bridge too far on that one." Rather than a visionary, Lucas decided he was better off with a workhorse, preferably one who had worked in television, where it was generally accepted that the director was subservient to the executive producer. In early 1981, Lucas screened the thriller Eye of the Needle by the Welsh director Richard Marquand, who had spent much of his career directing television movies, including the 1979 biopic Birth of the Beatles. Like Lynch, Marquand too was invited to the ranch and spent the entire day with Lucas and Marcia, eating dinner, then talking late into the evening. "Lucas thought Richard was a director he would feel comfortable with," said one insider. "One who could understand that essentially it'd be George's movie." That was fine with Marquand. "I was bowled over by Star Wars," he said. "What made me hesitate about directing Jedi was the fact that anybody would consider me for such a picture." Furthermore, Lucas liked that Marquand respected the need to bring in a project on time and on budget. But mostly, he liked that the soft-spoken Marquand was willing to adhere as closely as possible to Lucas's vision for the movie. Said Marquand later, "I always had the feeling that possibly I'd find myself in a situation where I was a horse dragging this thing along, with George holding the reins." He had no idea. The last missing piece to be found was the screenwriter. For Jedi, Lucas wanted to write an entire script himself first, rather than just handing off a story treatment to a screenwriter, as he had done with Empire. But the writing was a chore, as usual, and Lucas found himself leaving blank the final pages of a revised draft, knowing full well they could be fixed when he handed the script off to his screenwriter of choice, Lawrence Kasdan. Lucas hadn't been entirely sure whether Kasdan would take the job, now that Body Heat had put him on the map as a successful writer-director, but it turned out that all Lucas had to do was ask. "I was surprised to find myself writing Jedi, because I was already a director and I had no intention of writing for anyone ever again," said Kasdan. "But George asked me as a favor, and he'd already been so helpful to me." In early summer 1981, Lucas called Kasdan, Kazanjian, and Marquand out to Parkhouse for a story meeting to work out the details of the plot. There were several elements Lucas knew he needed. He wanted to feature Jabba the Hutt, now that he finally had the resources to build the character he had envisioned, then scrapped, in Star Wars. He wanted Luke to have a twin sister, though he still wasn't certain it was Leia. And he wanted a primitive society aiding the rebels, another idea he'd lifted from the early drafts of Star Wars, in which he'd brought a planet of Wookiees to the aid of the heroes. At the same time, he also had Macquarie and Joe Johnston at ILM sketching ships and creatures, with little idea where or how any of them fit into the movie. A free-for-all, as one ILM artist described it. "The process was the same for Jedi as for Empire," recalled Kasdan. "There were designs and pictures of things before I even started writing." The toughest part of the script was ensuring they gave every character something memorable to do. And Kasdan, looking for dramatic impact, suggested killing someone off, arguing that it would give the movie more emotional weight if someone you love is lost along the way. But Lucas dismissed such suggestions outright. "You don't have to kill people," he told Kasdan with just a hint of annoyance. "You're a product of the 1980s. You don't go around killing people. It's not nice." Still, Lucas wasn't above teasing Kasdan about his desire to inject a little angst into the script. As he described Luke dragging the mortally wounded Vader to safety near the conclusion of the film, Lucas, with a straight face, suggested the ultimate twist. "Luke takes Vader's mask off, and then Luke puts it on and says, 'Now I am Vader. Surprise! Now I will go and kill the fleet, and I will rule the universe. Kasdan could barely contain his enthusiasm. That's what I think should happen, he told Lucas. No, 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 Lucas shot back, slightly exasperated. Come on, this is for kids. Star Wars had been born of Lucas's own love of comic books, fairy tales, and Saturday morning serials. His way, as he had said at the time, of giving a new generation its own mythology. There would be no bittersweet endings, no killing off of central characters, no heroes turning evil. The whole point of the film is for you to be real uplifted, emotionally and spiritually, and feel absolutely good about life, Lucas explained to Kasdan. That is the greatest thing that we could possibly ever do. Not everyone shared Lucas's optimism. George has a predisposition for happy endings, sighed Harrison Ford. Even Hamill, the comic book fan who was nearly always inclined to give the story the benefit of the doubt, admitted to being somewhat disappointed in Jedi's lack of heft, complaining to Lucas that it all seemed so pat. Lucas smiled. So are fairy tales. As Kasdan went on his way to write the next draft of the script, Lucas had his legal team working to wrap up the legal and financial negotiations with Fox, which had been dragging on for nearly 2 years. With Ladd now out of the picture, Lucas wasn't inclined to negotiate nicely, and discussions hadn't gone well, with Fox griping that the percentage of the profits Lucas was offering was so low that the studio wouldn't have much incentive to promote the film. Lucas had little sympathy for their complaints, and little patience. Once again, he was going to be putting all of his own money on the line. But after tying up nearly all of his Empire profits in the ranch, Lucas didn't have enough on hand to cover the $30 million he thought it would take to make Jedi. That gave Fox some much-desired leverage, financing in exchange for profits. But Lucas wasn't going to make it easy on them. And when negotiations between Lucasfilm and Fox began to falter, with Grieber playing with relish the role of the bad cop, Lucas finally gave Fox an ultimatum. Reach an agreement within 30 days, or he would take his movie to another studio. Fox, now under the leadership of CEO Marvin Davis, a former oil man and an amiable enough blowhard, did its best to stand firm. The studio was still willing to take a lopsided deal on the gross receipts, though it was pushing for its piece of the pie to actually increase as the film earned more and more money, rather than bottoming out, as it had with Empire. Lucas eventually agreed that in exchange for a loan of $20 million, Fox's share in the profits would increase incrementally as the film made money, topping out at 40% once the film cleared $105 million. There were other sticky details to work out involving television, cable, and video rights. Fox was greedy, complained Grieber. But the deal still tilted heavily in Lucasfilm's favor. After inking the 224-page final contract, the 6'4" Davis draped an enormous arm over Lucas's shoulder. Georgie boy, drawled Davis, you're going to make me rich with movies. Lucas was doing just fine in that regard without Davis. In June 1981, Raiders of the Lost Ark had premiered to near unanimous raves from audiences and critics. One of the most deliriously funny, ingenious, and stylish American adventure movies ever made, wrote Vincent Canby in the New York Times, applauding Lucas and Spielberg as a happy collaboration. In the pages of Time, Richard Schickel hailed the film as surely the best 2 hours of pure entertainment anyone is going to find, and compared it favorably to the kind of movie Walt Disney might have made had he lived into the 1980s. In the Chicago Sun-Times, Roger Ebert reviewed the film almost feverishly, cheering Raiders as an out-of-body experience, a movie of glorious imagination and breakneck speed that grabs you in the first shot, hurdles you through a series of incredible adventures, and deposits you back in reality 2 hours later, breathless, dizzy, wrung out, and with a silly grin on your face. Not everyone was as enthusiastic. While Pauline Kael had been won over by the more adult-themed Empire Strikes Back, she was disappointed in both Lucas and Spielberg for reverting to what she regarded as childish entertainment. There's no exhilaration in this dumb motor excitement, lamented Kael. If Lucas weren't hooked on the crap of his childhood, If he brought his resources to bear on some projects with human beings in them, there's no imagining the result. Essentially, George Lucas is in the toy business. It was a punch that Cale couldn't land. Lucas liked being in the toy business. Those looking for art, he insisted, needed to look elsewhere. I don't take it that seriously, Lucas said. My films are closer to amusement park rides than to a play or novel. You get in line for a second ride. Roger Ebert put it best by putting it succinctly. Raiders wants only to entertain. It succeeds. It succeeded spectacularly, albeit slowly. The first weekend grosses, totaling a little more than $8 million, were somewhat disappointing, though perhaps unsurprising as the film had been released with little hype or promotion. Even the movie poster played up the collaboration of Lucas and Spielberg more than the film itself. Once again, Lucas and Spielberg kept an eye on things from a beach in Hawaii, building their usual good luck sandcastle as the numbers came in. I thought we had failed, Spielberg said, except this time, the sandcastle lasted a long time. It didn't get washed away right away, which is always our way of guessing if the film has legs. We have this weird superstition. Raiders of the Lost Ark would earn more than $160 million before the end of 1981, making it the year's highest-grossing movie. By April 1982, it would be the fourth highest-grossing film of all time, sitting behind Star Wars, Jaws, and The Empire Strikes Back. Superstition, indeed. George and Marcia Lucas arrived in London on January 7, 1982, 4 days before filming on Revenge of the Jedi was scheduled to begin at Elstree. They didn't arrive alone. 5 months earlier, after years of trying unsuccessfully to conceive, the Lucases had adopted a newborn baby girl they named Amanda. Lucas had held her in his hands only hours after she was born, and immediately felt himself a changed man. "Just like a bolt of lightning hit me," he said. "The challenge is always trying to do something that's all-consuming while having a private life," he explained later. "I had made the decision, after Star Wars, that I had certain goals in my private life. One was to be independent of Hollywood, the other was to have a family. When you have kids, you have a priority in your life." Lucas may have meant it, but as work progressed on Jedi, he'd find it harder and harder to make his family his priority. And by the time work on the film was complete, his private life would be in shambles. Lucas had hired Richard Marquand largely because he sensed Marquand would stay closest to his own vision for the film. There would be no comic ad-libs or artsy restaging of shots that had already been storyboarded. And once Lucas arrived in London, he all but took over the film. "George came and he never left," said producer Robert Watts. Richard couldn't grasp it, and George was concerned, so he never left. Lucas had hovered over Kirshner during Empire, but Kirshner had been an older, more seasoned director who was still willing to push back at his producer. Not so the low-key Marquand. "He was intimidated by George," said production designer Norman Reynolds. Marquand compared his job to trying to direct King Lear with Shakespeare in the next room. Lucas knew he was in Marquand's way, but he didn't care. Marquand was essentially doing a movie that's been established and, ultimately, "I'll have the final say," said Lucas. Cast and crew tended to look at Lucas for direction or guidance, even with Marquand standing nearby. Marquand, scrambling for control of the film, tried to put the best face on things, insisting that he really did want Lucas on the set, providing input. "If I am going to do this properly, you've got to give me your time," he told Lucas. "I like my producer around, and you're more than the producer. You wrote this goddamn thing, so let's get it right." But Lucas did more than just provide suggestions or direct second unit. "George harassed Richard Marquand into more or less doing what he wanted," said Kurtz. Most mornings, Lucas would ask to see Marquand's shot list for the day, an intensely private list most directors guard like a diary. To ensure he got the shots he wanted, Lucas insisted that Marquand film in the documentary style Lucas had used on Star Wars, with multiple cameras catching the action from various angles, and then choosing the best shot in editing. Marquand found it all exasperating. "I imposed my will a little bit, as I have a tendency to do, Lucas admitted. I hadn't realized that ultimately, it's probably easier for me to do these things than to farm them out. Marquand could only stand by, said Watts, and take in what George said and make it sound like it was his idea as well. That didn't mean all of Lucas's ideas were popular. Both cast and crew alike found his new heroes, the Ewoks, somewhat grating. Lucas had sent the characters back through design again and again, finally settling on a cuddly teddy bear-like look. Dare to be cute, Lucas told Rolling Stone later. The worst we could do is get criticized for it. Ralph McQuarrie had thrown up his hands in resignation over the creatures. There was a feeling that this was maybe too obvious a marketing idea, said one designer. I think Ralph didn't like that too much. But Lucas loved them, instructing second unit director Roger Christian to get lots of footage of Ewoks dancing and celebrating for Jedi's final scene. So I started doing that, and George fell in love with it, but I said, please get me off this, said Christian. The fact was, George loved them. Nobody else did. Lucas was so enchanted by one of the young actors inside the costumes, 11-year-old Warwick Davis, playing the feisty Ewok Wicket, that he signed him to another film that was still just a wisp of an idea, a fairy tale with a little person as the hero that would eventually become Willow. The final weeks on Jedi were spent on location, with the desert around Yuma, Arizona, standing in for Tatooine, and the redwoods of Crescent City, California, doing duty as the forest moon of Endor. To keep the production a secret, Lucas, Kazanjian, and Lucasfilm's marketing department had hats, clipboards, and film cans labeled with the name of a fictitious horror movie called Blue Harvest. The facade quickly fell away in Yuma, however, when dune buggy enthusiasts caught a glimpse of Harrison Ford on Jabba the Hutt's enormous skiff and surmised what was really going on. As he had in London, Lucas shadowed Marquand around the Arizona desert, doing more than just advising as Marquand shot the elaborate fights and stunts. Richard would set a lot of the shots up, but George was always there kind of like an advisor, said co-producer Jim Bloom diplomatically. Lucas was particularly frustrated with the mouth of the Sarlacc, visible at the bottom of an enormous pit dug into the desert sand. Lucas debated whether the monster should even be seen at all, and bickered with Kazanjian over the cost. The final creature, a large round mouth lined with rows of teeth, was horrifying, though it bore enough of a resemblance to a certain body part that Carrie Fisher took to referring to it as the sand vagina. Lucas could only sigh with irritation. By the time he reached Crescent City, his nerves were fraying, and his patience with Marquand and pretty much everyone else was nearly exhausted. I'm not having fun, he told one reporter testily. No matter how much I think everybody knows about Star Wars now, they don't. I've given Richard the answers to a million questions over the last year, filled everybody in on everything I can think of, and yet when we get here, the crew comes up with 1,000 questions a day. I'm not exaggerating, that only I can answer. I'm only doing this because I started it, and now I have to finish it. The next trilogy will be all someone else's vision. Principal photography on Jedi wrapped in mid-May 1982. Marquand had brought the film in on time and on budget. Crew members remarked that Marquand looked pale and ill, and, truth be told, Lucas didn't look great either. He'd lost 20 pounds over the past 5 months, which most attributed to exhaustion. What only very few people knew was that Lucas's private life was coming unraveled. Even as Lucas settled into ILM to oversee Jedi's effects, Ken Ralston, an ILM team member since Star Wars, noticed a definite change in his boss. We were wondering what happened to George, said Ralston. Jedi wasn't the same experience we'd had before. There was a definite lack of involvement with him directly. We weren't getting the kind of feedback and information that we got before, and you could feel something wasn't right. What wasn't right was that George and Marcia's 13-year marriage was quickly imploding, largely because of Lucas's own neglect. He knew he could be difficult to live with. It's been very hard on Marcia, living with somebody who is constantly in agony, uptight and worried, often never-never land, Lucas told Rolling Stone. Charles Lippincott, Lucasfilm's master of marketing, wasn't entirely surprised. He was one of the few in whom Marcia had confided, complaining to Lippincott that George just couldn't leave the stresses of filmmaking in the editing room. George would take problems to bed with him, said Lippincott, and Marcia said this caused a lot of problems. But it went even deeper than that. For George Lucas, movies would always be the other woman. As devoted to Marcia as he might be, there was forever one more movie, one more project, demanding the time and attention he couldn't or wouldn't give to his wife. And for all of his talk about making family a priority, Marcia was the one who had put her career on hold while he pursued one project after another, moving from Star Wars to More American Graffiti to Empire to Raiders to Jedi, with scarcely any downtime. Marcia had finally had enough. For me, the bottom line was just that he was all work and no play, she explained later. I felt that we paid our dues, fought our battles, worked 8 days a week, 25 hours a day. I wanted to stop and smell the flowers. I wanted joy in my life. And George just didn't. He was very emotionally blocked, incapable of sharing feelings. He wanted to stay on that workaholic track, the empire builder, the dynamo, and I couldn't see myself living that way for the rest of my life. Lucas insisted that part of that empire was for her. If he could equip Skywalker with a state-of-the-art editing and mixing system, she could essentially edit from home. If a director wants her to edit, it will be much easier to convince him to do it up here, Lucas said. The whole reason for the ranch, actually, it's just a giant facility to allow my wife to cut film in Marin County. It was too little, too late. For once the marriage had gone cold, Marcia began to look elsewhere for the warmth she craved from Lucas, finding it in the company of Tom Rodriguez, an artist 9 years younger than herself, who had been hired to create the ornate stained glass windows in the library dome at Skywalker Ranch. Marcia insisted she hadn't actually been unfaithful to her husband, at least not yet, and had suggested marriage counseling, hoping to salvage the relationship in therapy. But Lucas refused. As far as he was concerned, therapists and psychiatrists were nearly as untrustworthy as Hollywood executives. Marcia next suggested a trial separation. Lucas dismissed that option as well. Hoping to head off the argument in a less confrontational way, he had recently granted journalist Dale Pollack the access he needed to write an authorized biography, hoping that Marcia would be reminded of how much fun they used to have and how much they still loved each other. The two of them even attended George's 20th high school reunion together, where Lucas, in an effort to throw off the press, showed a sillier side by switching name tags with a similarly bearded classmate. None of it mattered. Marcia finally asked for a divorce, and all Lucas could do was beg her not to go public with the decision until after the release of Jedi, about a year away. But that wasn't going to make it easy on anyone. After sitting out Empire, Marcia was determined to help edit Jedi, along with Dwayne Dunham and Marquand's editor of choice, Sean Barton, who had cut Eye of the Needle. At that point, she and her husband were barely speaking. When Kazanjian asked Lucas whether Marcia was going to help edit Jedi, Lucas shrugged off the question with, "You're going to have to ask her." Marcia would mostly handle what Lucas mockingly called the dying and crying sequences, though as the most experienced editor of the three, she would usually get the last look at any cut before it went to Lucas. Kazanjian, who had double-dated with George and Marcia years earlier, now sadly watched them go their separate ways each evening. George would go home, said Kazanjian, and Marcia would stay in the editing room. Despite their best efforts to keep things civil, the two of them sometimes bickered in front of the crew. Barton remembered sitting hunched over his editing table one afternoon when Marcia mentioned to George that she wanted to recut a scene Barton had just completed. "You can make it different," Lucas snapped, "but you're not going to make it better." Marcia was tiring quickly of that kind of disparagement. "I felt I had something to bring to the table," she said later. "I was the more emotional person who came from the heart, and George was the more intellectual and visual, and I thought I provided a nice balance. But George would never acknowledge that to me. I think he resented my criticisms, felt that all I ever did was put him down. In his mind, I always stayed the stupid valley girl. He never felt I had any talent. He never felt I was very smart. He never gave me much credit. Marcia wasn't the only one Lucas squabbled with. Other crew members found him touchy, with a hair-trigger temper. One evening, Lucas became particularly annoyed with Dunham for pointing out that the current cut of the film made the fate of Vader unclear. "We just left him there on the Death Star, and we don't see him again," Dunham told Lucas. "Did he blow up in the Death Star, or did Luke take him, or what happened to him?" Kazanjian added that he too was concerned that audiences would be uncertain whether Vader was actually dead. "George got pretty heated," recalled Dunham. "It's rare to see George like that, but obviously that hit a nerve. I said, 'Okay, sorry I asked.'" But Lucas knew that Dunham and Kazanjian were right. Mark Hamill and a second unit crew were quickly dispatched to Skywalker Ranch to film Luke setting fire to Vader's funeral pyre. Looking back later, Lucas knew he'd been touchy and gloomy. "I was trying to finish the movie, but now I was also going through a divorce," he said. "I tried to hold myself together emotionally and still do the movie, but it was very, very hard. It was an act of great energy just to get up and go to work. I was so, so depressed." On a day in late November 1982 that came to be known around ILM as Black Friday, Lucas reordered or discarded nearly 100 special effects shots. "All of this stuff, all this material was just tossed out," moaned Ken Ralston, "and we couldn't even use them on other shots. It was bad." Lucas just rolled his eyes. He had no time for crybabies. "When they start screaming," he remarked, "you can tell whether it's a real scream or just kind of whiny." ILM, then, was going to have to hustle to get all the needed effects completed by February 1983, a task that seemed nearly impossible. Marcia, still editing the film next door at Sprocket, was so concerned about the ILM staff that she pulled aside ILM manager Tom Smith in tears. "She worried we weren't aware of how serious the deadline was," recalled Smith, "and said it was keeping her awake at night." Lucas wasn't buying it. "If she was breaking into tears, it probably had nothing to do with the movie," he said dismissively. Still, ILM added extra shifts to keep production running nearly around the clock, and Lucas would come in every morning at 8:45 to check on things personally. He would watch footage in the cozy screening room. His reserved seat was second row center, noting his approval or disapproval, then would run over to Sprocket to supervise Ben Burt dubbing in sound, or loiter behind Dunham as he cut in effect shots. But the looming deadline was affecting both the special effects and the editing. At ILM, Lucas found himself approving effects that he knew weren't up to their usual standards, while at Sprocket, he was gnashing his teeth in frustration over the problematic battle at the Sarlacc pit, a sequence that contained more edits than any other scene in the movie. Lucas had grown particularly annoyed with the character of Boba Fett. "I don't know whether it was the way it was shot, but Boba didn't measure up to some standard George had," said Dunham. Lucas had finally had enough. In the name of time, and no small bit of frustration, Boba Fett would be given one of the most anticlimactic demises in film history. "Just throw him in the pit," sighed Lucas. As production continued on Jedi throughout 1982, it probably came as little surprise to Marcia that her husband, despite his repeated promises that family was his new priority, had already started work on yet another film, falling this time into the waiting arms of Indiana Jones. With the enormous success of Raiders of the Lost Ark had come talk of the inevitable sequel, and Lucas had taken it on himself to write a treatment called Indiana Jones and the Temple of Death, completing the 20-page draft at the end of May 1982, just as Jedi was wrapping in London. The relics being pursued this time were holy Shankara stones, Lucas admitted later. "I couldn't think of another MacGuffin that I thought would work," which Indy has to retrieve from an Indian temple, saving the enslaved children of a nearby village in the process. The story was darker, The humor as black as Lucas's own disposition as his marriage crumbled. I wasn't in a good mood, Lucas admitted. Spielberg, too, was under a black cloud, the result of a recent accident on the set of the Spielberg-produced Twilight Zone the movie that had killed actor Vic Morrow and two children. Spielberg was never charged or investigated in the incident, which had resulted in indictments of several crew members, including director John Landis. But the entire experience had rocked and depressed the normally upbeat Spielberg. Their respective moods scared off writer Lawrence Kasdan, whom Lucas approached about turning his notes into a script. I didn't want to be associated with Temple of Doom, said Kasdan later. I just thought it was horrible. It's so mean. There's nothing pleasant about it. I think Temple of Doom represents a chaotic period in both their lives, and the movie is very ugly and mean-spirited. Instead, Lucas would hand his treatment off to Willard Hike and Gloria Katz, his collaborators on American Graffiti, instructing them to write quickly so they could get a full script over to an ambivalent and increasingly busy Spielberg. I'm afraid we might lose him, Lucas told the Hikes, so you guys better get this done fast. The Hikes, long used to working from Lucas's story treatments, had a first draft script in front of Spielberg in August. There were plenty of in-jokes, continuing a habit of naming characters after pets. The character Short Round was named for the Hikes' own dog. And the Hikes had infused the script with some of their own love of Indian culture and films like Gunga Din. But the somber and sometimes frightening tone Lucas had set in his story treatment remained intact. Some Lucasfilm staffers also worried that the film might be too violent, a concern that would plague the film right up until the moment of its release. Hike and Katz would continue to tinker with the script on into 1983, completing the shooting script, now called Indiana Jones and the Temple of Doom, on April 10th. Less than 2 weeks before shooting was scheduled to begin. Lucas, looking for any distractions before the premiere of Jedi in May, joined Spielberg and the Temple of Doom crew on location in Sri Lanka in late April, finally touching down in a helicopter near the Kandy River, where the film crew had constructed a long rope bridge over a ravine. 6 days later, Lucas took a second unit crew to film the sequence in which Indiana Jones cuts the bridge's supporting ropes with a machete, sending a number of villains tumbling into the river below. As Lucas rolled camera, the supporting cables were blown with a small explosion. The bridge, now split in half, collapsed against opposite sides of the cliff, and 14 dummies plummeted into the ravine below, mechanical arms flailing. Lucas loved it. He lingered in Sri Lanka for several more days, engaging in squirt gun fights with Spielberg and watching romantic sparks fly between Spielberg and the film's leading lady, Kate Capshaw. Most thought Lucas appeared tired. When Lucas sat down for an extended interview with Rolling Stone later that month, the interviewer noted that he looked so gloomy, so unhappy, so downright miserable. Ken Ralston at ILM thought Lucas seemed totally fried. Fried or not, there was still Jedi to attend to. And on May 7th, Lucas screened a special preview of the film for Lucasfilm employees at San Francisco's Coronet Theater. For the most part, he was pleased with the final film, though he still regretted that he'd been unable to get the Ewoks to blink. He would fix that decades later through digital technology. He'd also renamed the film at practically the last minute, rightly deciding that revenge was a trait unbecoming a Jedi Knight, and substituted the word return instead. The change required the recall of movie posters that had already been printed with the old title. Lucas would make them available for sale exclusively to members of the Star Wars fan club. The opening of Return of the Jedi on Wednesday, May 25th, 1983, was officially an event. The cliffhangers from Empire had audiences lining up for a day in advance, counting down the hours, minutes, and seconds until the premiere of the film, in which they'd see how everything was resolved. Fans debated the fate of Han Solo and bickered over the identity of the other Yoda had mentioned. People skipped out of work. Many of those who didn't would take their school-aged children to the midnight showing, threw parties, celebrated birthdays, even held screenings of the first two movies while waiting in line. One fan even tried to steal the film at gunpoint. As always, Star Wars was all about the experience of seeing it. Return of the Jedi opened in 820 theaters across the United States and Canada, quite a step up from the 126 in which Empire had debuted 3 years earlier, and shattered records for the largest opening day gross, with ticket sales of $6.1 million. Just as they had when The Empire Strikes Back premiered, most studios didn't bother to open a movie against Jedi, holding back big releases like Superman 2 and the latest James Bond film, Octopussy. Jedi was going to have to earn $115 million to break even, but from day one, its success seemed inevitable. After doing about $46 million in the first week, we knew that we would make our money back shortly, said Kazanjian. It would do so in less than 5 weeks, and by the end of 1983, when the film was still playing after 32 weeks in release, Return of the Jedi was closing in fast on the $250 million mark. Critics were split, and even those who gave it positive reviews often found reasons to hedge their bets. Gary Arnold at the Washington Post called it a triumph, though he thought Harrison Ford looked tired. Time magazine, which had gambled correctly on the success of the film by putting Lucas on the cover, hailed Jedi as a brilliant, imaginative piece of filmmaking, but cautioned Lucas and other filmmakers against relying too much on special effects and creatures, a criticism that would be leveled against him and his three Star Wars prequels 20 years later. ILM artist Joe Johnston, discussing Jedi with journalist Gerald Clark, said perhaps too truthfully, "We were never sure whether the movie was a vehicle for the effects or for the story." A few even figured out that Lucas had finally made his Vietnam movie. "You can look at Jedi and see the Vietnam War there," said Kazanjian. "You can see the Ewok guerrillas hiding in the jungles, taking on this improper force of mechanized bullies, and winning." Most of the negative criticism leveled at the film tended to train its fire on either the acting or Marquand's directing. One of the film's harshest critics, John Simon at National Review, took to the television news show Nightline to lament that Jedi was dehumanizing and, cryptically, that it made children dumber than they needed to be. An amused Gene Siskel and Roger Ebert, appearing on the same show to refute Simon, flatly told the critic he needed to lighten up. Lucas heard none of it. As usual, 4 days before the film's release, he had left for Hawaii, this time spending 2 weeks in Honolulu, waiting for the phone calls that would bring him the box office numbers. He was relieved to be done with it, not just Jedi, but Star Wars as a whole. "That dumb screenplay I first wrote 10 years ago is at least finished," he told Rolling Stone. "It's all in a movie now. It's been 10 years since I started this. There hasn't been a day in my life where I haven't gotten up in the morning and said, 'Gee, I've got to worry about this movie.' Literally, not one single day." To Time magazine, he compared the making of the Star Wars trilogy to pushing a train slowly up a hill, then holding on for dear life as it careened down the other side. "I'm burned out," he admitted wearily. "In fact, I was burned out a couple of years ago, and I've been going on momentum ever since. Star Wars has grabbed my life and taken it over against my will. Now I've got to get my life back again, before it's too late." Getting his life back meant moving forward without Marcia. On Monday, June 13th, Lucas called an all-hands meeting at Skywalker Ranch. Staff gathered to find George and Marcia holding hands as they tearfully announced they were getting divorced. The staff was stunned. They'd had no idea. "They were a team," said Sprocket manager Jim Kessler. "If he was black, she was white, and vice versa. It was a well-balanced thing. Independently, they were kind of like balls with unweighted sides, so they spun out in goofy ways." Marcia would relocate immediately to Los Angeles. Their daughter Amanda, now 2 years old, would remain largely in George's custody, one of the few conditions of the divorce that Lucas truly embraced. "I've got a daughter now, and she's growing up around me, and she's not going to wait," said Lucas. "I don't want her to grow up to be 18 and have her say, 'Hey, Dad, where have you been all my life?'" The ranch would remain his work in progress, but with the exception of Indiana Jones and the Temple of Doom, which was still in production in London, he was done with movies, at least for a while. He was taking at least a 2-year sabbatical from filmmaking, he told Time. Family became my first priority, he said later. I didn't think it was going to be, because before that, making films was my first priority. But then I realized that this was my life, and then I was divorced, and it really was my life. So I just simply said, okay, I'm retiring. I put my companies and the making of movies and everything on the side. Steven Spielberg wasn't so sure Lucas could ever retire. He had heard it all before. Every time George is making a film, he talks about retiring and never working again, said Spielberg. But the minute it is finished, he is already thinking up his next opus. I can see him running Lucasfilm, making 3 to 5 pictures a year, and then someday returning to directing, which is where I think he belongs. I believe his destiny is behind the camera. But Lucas insisted he meant it, especially when it came to Star Wars. I look upon the 3 Star Wars films as chapters in one book. Now the book is finished, and I have put it on the shelf. As far as he was concerned, he was never taking that particular book down off the shelf again. Not ever.